Good evening, one and all. Yes, a few issues, a few gremlins to start with. And I had this last time. I tried to get my guests on the show. Today was another one, but we got there in the end. And I am glad to say I am here, and so is my guest. Now, my guest, he is the youngest. I'm telling you, the youngest ever recipient of a special award for historical writing. He has written a book, and he's a teenager, and the book is about a teenager as well, life and searching for things and stuff like that. The only thing is, between the person who wrote it and the protagonist, both being teenagers, but the age gap between them is about 4,000 years. Yes, you heard me, 4,000 years. Well, I better introduce my guest and we can find out a bit more about this. Because on the show today, I have the one and only Michael Hoffman. Hi, Michael, how you doing?
I'm very well today.
Good. I'm glad you are, and I'm glad we finally managed to get this show together. But you know, it's always the best things are always worth waiting for, isn't it, Michael? As I said in the book, you know, it is a bit of a gap between your own teenage life and the protagonist's teenage life. But the thing is, you based this. Well, a lot of people, perhaps during the pandemic and everything, and you wanted to do stuff, wanted to learn something, stuff like that. You, in middle school, decided to learn not just a language, but Egyptian hieroglyphics, was it?
Yes, that's right. During the pandemic, I didn't know what to do. You know, I just had so much time. I was 12 years old at the time, and I decided to learn this new language, and I was fascinated by it.
Yeah, I mean, have you always been like into history, historics and that sort of stuff, or was it just something you thought, this is interesting, I think I'll learn this?
I think it's both, really. I mean, I've always been interested in history, and I've always loved studying the past. Mm-hmm. When I was young, I used to read this book called The Osborne Encyclopedia of World History. And, you know, it's wonderful because it's filled with all these illustrations that where you can see the cutaway of a Roman house, mm-hmm. Or a Greek amphitheater. And then, you know, ever since I read that book, I've always loved history. But part of it was just, you know, I was interested in ancient Egypt specifically. And, you know, I decided, why not, you know? I had lots of time, so why not learn this cool new language?
And did you sort of set down to write a book, or I think I read somewhere the first thing was you started trying to translate literally Egyptian stories. Was that how it went, or did you sit with the book first?
Well, first I just learned the language, and that took about a year. Yeah, because it's a little more difficult than English.
Just a bit, yeah.
just a little bit, not that much, but. Right. And then I first began translating the text. And then I decided that I think it'd be great to write a book and to share, you know, this translation of the text with the wider public. And let me just talk for a minute about what the text is actually about.
Right.
So it's about a 4,000-year-old papyrus, and it's written by a man named Khadi, an Egyptian scribe named Khadi, who's in the story, he calls himself a miner, and he says he's bringing his son down the Nile to the capital of Egypt on a boat, and he wants to bring his son to the capital of Egypt so that he can enroll his son in scribal school. Mm-hmm. And so he basically wants his son to have a chance at a better life as a scribe, right, than the father would ever have as a miner, and as a miner, someone who mines things. Mm-hmm. And along the way, he's telling his son about all the other jobs that his son could have if he doesn't get to become a scribe. So, for example, he could be a carpenter, or he could be a fisherman. And then he tells his son why all these jobs are the worst jobs in the whole land of Egypt, why he should never want them, and why the fisherman is getting eaten by crocodiles, and You know, if he cares about himself, he should study hard in scribal school to become a scribe, because the job of the scribe is the best job in the whole land of Egypt, and there's no other job like it. So that's essentially the whole basis of the story. It's quite a fascinating story, especially it's a really good one to explain Egyptian history to the public, because after each job in the book, Be a Scribe, after each job, I added an explanatory inset of what the job was actually like.
Because, okay.
You know, Teddy, he's a little bit exaggerated, you know? Mm-hmm. He says things like the tenant farmer never gets to sleep, or he exaggerates things a lot. He embellishes the story.
Yeah, it's interesting because in many ways, it hasn't really changed, has it? The father sort of saying to his son, stay out of trouble, mind your manners, don't play hooky, follow the orders and stuff like that. And the father trying to help the son and to help with his future and that. It hasn't really changed that much.
No, people are pretty much the same. The societies have changed. The technology is very different, but the human condition hasn't changed all that much. It's interesting to see.
So go ahead.
And at the end of the story, like you were just saying, you know, he gives his son advice about how to survive in the capital, and he says things like, "Don't overeat," and "Don't stand up when someone who's more important than you is still sitting down." So it shows that, like, you know, humans are still dealing with gluttony then, just as we are now. Mm. You know.
Yeah, I mean, you've added, as you said, you've added this sort of your own explanation and a bit of colour and some humour. I read as well, to the actual facts, to make it. Is that a case of making it more relatable, or a case of bringing it? I guess not up to date, but yeah, making it more easy for somebody to read and understand.
Yes, it makes it. I think it makes it, the explanations make it more easy for someone to really understand its translation. Because I mean, it is a 4,000-year-old piece of it is a 4,000-year-old text. So
right.
I mean, it shouldn't be like, you know, perfectly crystal clear. And also, the explanations dive into aspects of, let's say, aspects of Egyptian buildings, how Egyptian buildings were built that the text doesn't necessarily describe.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, we like everything, you know, we find out stuff all the time. I think nearly every day on the BBC, I saw like some ship's been found, or something's been found, or they've dug something up that's been missing for, you know, thousands of years. We never stop, I don't think, finding stuff and learning stuff. I mean, let's face it, everything's a learning curve these days, and some of it goes back thousands and thousands of years. You had some help with Be a Scribe, Dr. Casey and Dr. Tum. Did they help? How did they help you?
Well, Dr. Casey was the one who actually taught me hieroglyphs.
And
as I was doing the translation, you know, of course, they're both PhDs in Egyptology. They received their PhD from Brown. And so, as I was going through the translation, I'd only been learning the Egyptian language for a year. So if I ever got stuck on any piece of the translation, then they were always there to help me out, you know.
What did they think of somebody, you know, your age suddenly getting into this and then wanting to sort of translate stuff for people today? Was it a bit of a surprise for them?
For my parents, you mean?
No, for the doctors.
Oh, Dr. Christian Casey, how I originally got in contact with him was how I originally wanted to take a summer course, actually, before the pandemic.
Okay. Yeah, right.
He was teaching one at Brown, and then of course it was canceled. So I reached out to him to ask if he wanted to just teach me online on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And he said yes. So he's somewhat, and they're both very familiar with, you know, teaching members of the public, because Dr. Casey had during the pandemic, he ran a course online where he taught people late Egyptian. And Dr. Thumb, she works for the Harvard Art Museum, so she does lectures, pretty often for students and other members of the public. So they're both somewhat used to it.
Right. How long did it take you to sort of get the translation and then sort of make it into a readable story?
Well, okay, so essentially, first what I did was I did a transcription of the text, which meant that I basically took the Egyptian symbols and turned them into how it would sort of like sound in like our own language, you could say. Like I typed the sounds as like the Roman alphabet. And then using the Roman alphabet, that transcription, I then translated that into the English. And that was a very rough literal translation. And then after that rough translation, I went back and I edited the translation to make it sound better and more understandable and more natural, like a piece of writing.
Okay. So, yeah, so you did the translation and then smoothed it into, yeah, I understand, right. As I said at the beginning, you're the youngest ever recipient, and it's the annual Emerson Prize that you won, awarded by Concord Review for Outstanding Promise in History. That you must have been pretty proud of winning an award like that.
Yes, actually. But the funny thing is that that award and the book actually are not actually related. That award, I told you I've always been interested in history.
Yeah.
That award was actually for a different paper that I wrote.
Yeah.
That paper was about a completely different subject, a completely different time. It was about a 19th century scam. It's actually really cool. Do you mind if I talk about it?
Of course, no, please do.
It was called the Gingrich Game, and it operated in New York City in the late 1900s. Uh-huh. And essentially how it worked was the operatives would send out letters to, gullible members of the public from all over the country, and they would say, if you give me $500 of your own real money, then I'll give you $5,000 and perfect counterfeit money. And they sometimes would even enclose little samples of this supposedly counterfeit money, but the counterfeit money was in fact genuine. And so they would tell their victims, come to New York City so we can do this trade. And they would show the victims a briefcase of the counterfeit money, and they say, this is what you're getting. And they put it, under a table. And then at the last moment, someone would, remove a board from the floor and switch out the case containing the real genuine money that the victim thinks is counterfeit,
right,
with a case containing sawdust. And
then
the operative above the floor would hand the victim the case of the sawdust and say, here's your case, but don't open it until you get to the train because you don't want any police to see you. Right. And then the victim would open it on the train and you'd see his sawdust. And one police chief said, it's the would-be swindler that has been swindled because... And he can't report the crime
because
he's conspiring to commit a crime.
Yeah.
So it's quite an ingenious crime. And, I was detailing the history of that paper detailed the history of that crime and how the police were very corrupt at that period of time. And so the operatives would just pay off the police in exchange for protection. And then eventually the scheme declined as the police became less corrupt. But it's just interesting to see.
Wow. Oh, so that sounds interesting. I love one of the things in England I used to watch a lot, and they stopped for a while, but they brought it back and they tried it with different people. But now, thank goodness, they got Tony Robinson back again. Is Time Team? I don't know if you ever come across that program, an English program, but they do like an archaeological dig in like 3 days. And in England we have sort of history every 2 yards sort of thing, Roman villas coming out,
yeah,
the gazoo sort of thing. But it's very interesting because you learn so much along the way, like you said, about the sort of layout of the various buildings and the underwater heating of Roman building and underfloor heating and that of the Roman buildings and everything like that. And it's so good to learn all that sort of thing, and that's what I was sort of grew up on myself. Obviously, with the history we've got, and even these days I read a lot about sort of 18th, 19th century seafaring stuff I think it was just this last week I found something different out about, it was about the Baltic and the Swedish and the Danish and the Norwegian thing was a sort of annex of Denmark and that with Napoleon and all that sort of stuff, which I never knew before. I never knew about the sort of separation of those countries, which is always worth learning about, I think, sort of thing. And it's great with this book that you've done, with the fact that you are helping not just give a story, but an education as well. And I read it's possibly the first of several books along this same line.
Yes, I do hope that I'll be able to write a similar book to be a scribe, but with a different Egyptian text. And I think that the one I'm planning next should be one that, this book details a lot about jobs and the economy, but the next one should talk a little bit more about religion and Egypt's relationship with the other empires and countries that were existing at the same time as it.
I mean, because what is it, Ra the third or first, Amen Ra, he was the first person to come up with the fact that it was just one supreme god, not all these different gods. And interesting that you go back to that time, for, like in all religions since then, the one main deity, and it goes back to the Egyptian times. People don't realize that sort of thing.
Yes, it's interesting, the Amarna period. Even though after he died, he was, his whole legacy was erased. The Egyptians didn't like it.
What's the thing I was reading? Because I get a history magazine myself, and there was something about Cleopatra's daughter, I think it was. She did more for Egypt than Cleopatra. I think she married a Roman or something like that, and sort of reigned and kept Egypt going for about 40, 50 years. A quite amazing person. Is hieroglyphics something you continue to learn? Does it change through the centuries? Is there sort of different understandings for different symbols, or does it stick to what you've learned?
The Egyptian language did change over the centuries. There's Old Egyptian, which is the oldest form, and then Middle Egyptian, Late Egyptian, and then Ptolemaic Egyptian, and then there's actually still a modern descendant of the language. It uses a completely different alphabet, but that's the Coptic language.
Okay.
And it's written with the Greek alphabet, or a variant of the Greek alphabet, but many of the words are descended from the original Egyptian words, and that's the language that's used by the Coptic Christians in Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, people think, oh, it's symbols and stuff like that, but then you go back to was it the North language? And it was just lines and stuff like that. I can't remember the name of it now. Sort of the oldest, one of the oldest languages there is. And it was literally just lines, with sort of lines along and lines across, which is basically almost pictorial. It's just that the Egyptians are a bit more clever in doing pictures, sort of thing.
No. Yeah, I think it's called Akkadian, I believe.
Yeah, it's not the one word I'm looking for, but I think it's around that sort of thing. It's a one word. I think it's got a K in it or something. I can't remember. Anyway,
I think either Akkadian or Sumerian. One of the
okay.
Two.
Yeah, it just shows you. People think, languages and communications, and then Egyptians came along with the hieroglyphics. There's been lots of communication in different ways. It's just how we know, and they say there's, if not hundreds, if not thousands of languages that have got lost along the way, that we sort of, we just don't know about. Ogham, is that ring a bell? Ogham, is that the language
No,
I'm thinking of?
No,
that's the one I'm thinking of, Ogham, which is like a pictorial thing, but... Yeah, anyway, we know about these languages, but there are so many others that we don't know about, and we would never will, perhaps. But and it's great that with what you've done and what you've proven can be done, that it can be learned, it can be kept and not forgotten. And the fact that you're now able to communicate stuff that was written in a format that people today can understand and learn from, I think's quite amazing.
Yeah, no, I think so too. I mean, what you were saying about all the languages lost makes you wonder, yeah, you know, how many languages were just written down in sand or dirt or
yeah,
something.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, time's getting on, so what I'm going to do now is actually hand the show over to you and have you tell everybody where, Michael, where they can find more about you and, of course, your book.
Sure. So you can find, you can go to beascribe.com if you want to find more about that book. That's just spelled, you know, BEASCRIBE .com. And if you want to find more about my book, and that website also has links to the Amazon pages or Barnes & Noble's pages.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, it was Ogham. It's an alphabet used to write primitive and old Irish and Pictish. It's not as old as that. It's sort of like, early sort of about fourth, fifth century.
Argon, interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. O-G-H-A-M.
O-G-H-A-M.
Yeah. There's 400 surviving Orthodox inscriptions in monuments throughout Ireland and West Britain. And it's basically lines with cross lines. That's basically it.
Actually, that's a really cool language, I have to say.
Yeah. Invented as a cryptic on Christian script. That's what it says. Anyway, but yeah. Anyway, I remember coming across it. Somebody was, they found something on some stones somewhere. It might have been Oak Island or something like that. They found some on stones, and they sort of had to get somebody from Ireland to come over and translate it for them and stuff like that. But interesting. Anyway, great stuff talking to you. Very, very interesting, this whole Be a Scribe and how you got to it and what you've done to it with it. And I'm sure the next book that comes out is going to be equally entertaining and equally interesting and educational as well, because that's what it is. Michael, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. There you go. My guest today, Michael Hoffen, H-O-F-F-E-N. And we've been talking about his book, Be a Scribe, which is basically based on 4,000-year-old pictorials, as we were saying, and translated it, took the story, and smoothed it into, or changed it into, sort of modern day story type writing, and terrific. You see, you hear and you see things haven't changed a huge amount of time, a huge amount in those 4,000 years when you look at it. But it's a great book, great education, and I tell you should read it. Be a Scribe, Working for a Better Life in Ancient Egypt. Look out for it. Well, I'll be back tomorrow with another guest. But until then, as always, I have one thing left to say. Don't forget.